From Paul's house and Storm's house, it's Paul and Storm talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes, on average.
Oh, I start, don't I?
Yeah, you always forget that you're the one that goes first.
That was it. That was my thing.
Okay. Clap on, clap off, clap on, clap off the clapper. I'm Paul.
I'm Storm.
And we're going to talk about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average. Tonight, it is Sunday. It's Sunday. I'm going with that.
It's, you know what? I'm not even looking at the right place on my computer. It is Sunday, May 8th. Although I don't think we're putting this podcast up until Tuesday the 10th, but that's not what you asked. You asked what day it is today, and that's what it is. And this
correct.
Is episode, I've been shirking my duties too. What is today? Episode 112?
That sounds pretty good to me.
Let's go with that until I confirm otherwise.
It's a very special Paul and Storm podcast. First of all,
because it's the first we've done in like 3.5 weeks or something, so sorry we've been gone.
How much time is wasted, like, on blogs and podcasts discussing how horrible it is that we haven't been on?
Or how? I don't know. I mean, I didn't want to dwell. I just wanted to acknowledge the fact that we are aware that we haven't been on for a while. That was all.
Okay, well, that's the appropriate amount of dwelling, I think.
Yeah, that much. That's how much time is spent.
But it's not just special because we're actually doing it. We have with us today a friend of ours, someone that I think most of you know already. Maybe not personally, but you may know his writing and writings. And we're here mostly to discuss his latest. I know the suspense is killing you.
Well, there's no suspense for me because I know who it is.
Right.
You weren't talking to me, were you?
No, I was kind of talking to you.
Okay.
I was throwing to you, actually.
Oh, I see. See how I picked up on that cue. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the podcast, John Scalzi.
Yay, John Scalzi. Yay. The suspense was killing me. I was like, am I supposed to talk now? Did it just
vote?
What did I do? Did I already screw up?
You can see the well-oiled machine that this podcast is, John. I'm sure you're going to be impressed.
Everything about it just it screams competence. And that's... I'm thrilled to be here. Thrilled.
Thanks.
And don't worry, in our eyes, you can do no wrong. So,
Well, I mean, you know, if you were to kill one of my pets, maybe I would consider that wrong. But from sort of the way we're situated right now, I doubt there's very much you could do wrong.
No, your pets are a good minimum safe distance from me at the moment. So, it's all the same on this end.
So John Scalzi, author.
Yes.
Raconteur, do you want to give the maximum 90-second version of your career, or would you like us to try and summarize it?
Oh, I would love to hear your version of it.
John?
Let's trade off sentences, Paul. Let's see how this goes.
Okay, well, I'm cheating a little bit because I have your Wikipedia article in front of me, but I'm going to try and not reference it.
Well, you start because I know the facts, but I'm not going to stick to them.
Okay, John Scalzi was born...
In a log cabin in Kentucky.
Sometime he is roughly a year older than us. Ha ha. He did some stuff for a while, and then became a science fiction author, award winning,
and magician. Remember, I'm not stating facts here.
True.
This is all going to end up in the Wikipedia article, though, you know.
That's right. Actually, I'm editing. I should say I'm transcribing exactly what we're writing into your Wikipedia bio right now. And he's a hell of a guy.
Well, he's a Hugo Award-winning guy and nominated guy. Well, okay, that was true. I know I said I was.
Yeah, you're slipping in.
You're messing with the shtick. It's all downhill from here.
I know. That's okay. We started pretty low.
We'll, we'll talk a little bit about some of your previous works shortly, but the germane reason as to why you're here, besides the fact that you think that we're cool and you want to be associated with us, is that you have a brand new book coming out, well, as we speak, in 2 days, less than two full days time, called Fuzzy Nation.
A book that we were privileged to read previous to its release.
That's right. In case you were wondering what it's like to be famous, one of the perks is that you pull your cards and play your strings right, and you get to read John Scalzi books before they hit the general public.
That's right. As a matter of fact, I think you guys were one of the, I think, first like five people who read it. Not you two were the first five people, unless you've got more personalities than I know about. But I think it was you two, my wife, Jonathan Colton, and my longtime beta reader, Reagan Avery. And so you guys were the first ones to get the full fuzzy treatment, as it were. And boy, that sounds worse than it.
Yeah, that's a whole nother podcast right there. wow. Well, I didn't realize how privileged we were.
Yeah.
I feel that much more special. I kind of got a boner from learning that information.
Given your comments about the book, the feedback that you gave me at the time, that not entirely surprising. Would you like to tell the folks what you're?
Sure. Well, yeah. I'm known for my punch up skills and my literary criticism in general. And I read the book, and I told via email, I told John that I enjoyed it very much, except I thought that the characters of the fuzzies really should what it was missing was they all should have incredibly large genitalia, some of them multiple genitalia, and you should constantly be referring to the fuzzy people's genitalia. Unfortunately, it sounds like I haven't seen your final I didn't see the galleys or anything, but I don't believe you followed my advice, and that's your loss. I mean, we'll see how the book sales go.
You know what we're going to do? We're saving it for the inevitable director's cut is what that's going to come down to. We're going to sell for, the usual sort of theatrical cut. And then once we've done that, we're going to zero in on the actual, the true fans. And they're going to get the special Paul and Storm humongous genitalia edition.
The Paul and Storm remix.
Right, exactly.
Speaking of remixes, Fuzzy Nation, you actually bought the original intellectual property to reimagine it.
Sort of. I mean, what happened is the original novel, the 1962 novel by H. Beam Piper, is actually in the public domain. So when I was sort of thinking of this general idea of taking a previous novel and sort of adapting it into sort of modern sensibility, it was one that sort of recommended itself just on that part alone. But once I did it, once I wrote it, and I realized that, I could actually do something with it, two things happened. One, I didn't want the H. Beam Piper fans to sort of come out in the night and stab me through the eye, because some of them would.
Sure.
And the other thing is that one.
Wait, we're going to stop right here. Are you meaning to tell me that there are science fiction and fantasy writer fans who would rabidly defend things that they enjoy to the point of threatening violence?
It's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that, because as we all know, science fiction and fantasy fans are meek and mild in their opinions and tend to keep them to themselves.
They do.
However, in this particular case, I think if I just showed up and said, "Look what I did to Little Fuzzy," I think there might have been problems. So there was that. But the other thing is that once I decided that actually, no, this is something that we could actually move forward on and do something with. One of the things that I wanted to do is not just from the point of view of the fans, but from the point of view of the actual Piper Estate, be totally above board, saying, "Look, this is what I did. This is what I wrote. Please look at it. If you like it, or if this is something that you think you can get behind, I'm willing to, take a license from you and give you a cut, just so that everybody knows that it's above board and that morally and ethically we're in the clear." And so the folks who administer the estate took a look at the work and said, "Yeah, this works for me." It was the non-genital you know, Paul and Storm version, unfortunately.
Well, I showed to them. That's fine.
For those unfamiliar with the story, can you give a brief description of your version and or how you have adapted it?
Right. Well, my version is, in its rough outlines, pretty much the same as the original Little Fuzzy version. Mm-hmm. Fuzzy Nation centers on a character named Jack Holloway, who is a prospector on a planet called Zera 23. And he's prospecting specifically for these things called sunstones, which are a very rare gem. And he's just made a tremendous find.
You didn't go with unobtainium, did you?
Not unobtainium, you know. It's just so common these days, unfortunately, and ironically, as it were. But so he finds these gemstones, which is cool because he's got this windfall, and he's going to hand it over to the Zarathustra Corporation to do all the mining and stuff like that and take his cut. Mm-hmm. But around the same time he does that, he also discovers this cute little cat-monkey creature, which he promptly calls Fuzzies. And as the book goes on, it becomes clear that these are smarter than your average animals. And then the question becomes, are they sentient? And if they are sentient, this is a real problem, because that means that the Zarathustra Corporation can no longer strip mine the planet, because then it's somebody's actual home. And that's what the story becomes about, is, are these creatures sentient or not? What does that mean? What does that mean for the company? What does it mean for Jack Holloway? How do we deal with that? And so both of the books have that as their basic storyline. The difference between the books is how each of us go to describe the path of the story. I mean, mm-hmm. H. Beam Piper did it in a very specific way, and I do it in a very specific way, and both of those sort of are informed by who we are as people and what our concerns are, and also about the time in which we live in, because he was writing this in the early 60s and I'm writing it here in 2010 and 11. And so even though they're the same basic stories, mm-hmm. In many ways they just are they are executed in completely different ways, which is kind of cool.
Now, what originally drew you to the story? I know that we've read pretty much all of your books, and mm-hmm. that a common thread through them is this idea of sentience, consciousness, and exploring those ideas. Was that a major draw for you, or was it a story that you had loved when you were younger?
I think it's a little of column A and a little of column B. I mean, two things there. I mean, one, I read it as a kid, and H. Beam Piper's style was really attractive to me. I mean, here was someone who wrote in a very clear style and, you know, didn't have his prose get in the way of his story, and he told a really good story. Mm-hmm. So that was somebody that, as a writer, you know, as a young novice writer, going, oh, wow, I wish I could write like that. So that was part of it. It was, you know, the story was in my memory banks. But I think that you are correct. I mean, a lot of my stories, you know, Ghost Brigades particularly, mm-hmm. or Zoe's Tale, are very much about the idea of, you know, who are we as people? What are our obligations? What does it mean to be sentient, or what does it mean to be a particular type of person, and where do we go from there? So it's basically, yeah, this is something that's sort of my home field advantage, if you want to put it that way, in terms of subjects. So like I said, I mean, part of it was also just that curiosity of, you know, there are a whole bunch of stories from the golden age of science fiction, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, that are really good stories. But, you know, they were written in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And the sensibility of people at that time, particularly science fiction writers, is not the same as it is now. We're 50 years forward. There's been a lot of social changes and so on and so forth. And one of the things that I frequently say is science fiction is written about the future, but it's written now, whichever right. now is when it gets done. So if you read, you know, H. Beam Piper from 1960, or if you read Robert Heinlein from Stranger in a Strange Land, yeah. or any of those sorts of things, you read them and they're still really good stories, but you can also tell it's like, wow, it's been some time since this book came out, because it has some cultural assumptions that we don't have anymore. And so part of that interest was, can I take the same basic story, tell it in a setting, you know, that feels more modern to contemporary readers, and still pull the story off? Is the story an artifact of its time, or is it a timeless story that can be retold? And that was part of the experiment as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It certainly it has the brisk, good storytelling angle. And I don't say this in a kissy-assy way, but...
Well, you can say it in a kissy-assy way.
Not just in a kissy-assy way.
Well, right. I put that phrase in so it didn't come across totally as a kissy-assy way.
Right.
But it was so incredibly quick to read, mm-hmm. but not in a way that it was like, you know, a cookie-cutter story. But in the sure. sense that you always wanted to know what's going to happen next, which,
right.
you know, to me at least, is sort of the heart of storytelling.
Yeah, well, and that's something that I try to aim for too. I mean, one of the things that I think is one of my advantages as a writer is that I get bored extremely easily.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. I mean, if I'm writing something and I'm sitting there going, oh God, I can't believe I'm writing. You know, if I'm mm-hmm. bored writing it, you're going to be bored reading it. And yep. so basically, I'm my own worst critic on that one because, you know, we've all read the books where you're just going, could you please just get to the
yes.
thing where I want my lasers and explosions, damn you.
In the Paul and Storm organization, refer to that as informally refer to that situation as boiled leather.
Yeah.
We both plowed through the Song of Ice and Fire books, which we love tremendously, except George R. R. Martin has a great love of describing in loving detail the various different crests and outfits and mm-hmm. meals, and a lot of it is great towards scene setting. But when you are reading the 19th description of what some minor knight who's passing by on the road is wearing underneath his coverlet, it can get a little arduous.
Right. Well, and it's not just the science fiction and fantasy writers who do that too. I mean, Moby
yeah.
Dick's got, like, what, an entire chapter on Scrimshaw. And you're like sitting there going, really? Do I really need to know this about Scrimshaw? I mean, there's a direct line between Melville writing about Scrimshaw and Tom Clancy, like, you know, masturbating over the various, you know, armaments
yes.
of the submarines and planes and so on and so forth. It's all of a, you know, part of the rich tapestry of, you know, complete nerd gassing.
Yeah.
About details, and speaking personally, I just like I want whale, you know, not the Scrimshaw. Get me the whale.
I guess there must be readers who go in for that aspect, or it would never stand.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, and for them, you know, that's part of it's the world building thing, you know,
right.
where they're like, I totally believe it because you've thought this world down to what this minor knight who is just passing by is wearing underneath his armor. You know, that's your assurance that they've completely built out that world and
yeah.
And so on and so forth. And so one of the criticisms that I get, you know, which is totally fair if you're one of those people, is it's like, you don't spend any time describing it. It's like, well, no, you know, it's just like, you know, it's a spaceship. They're on a spaceship. You want to think what the spaceship is. You have lots of models of spaceships in your brain. Go ahead and pick the one that works for you.
Right.
Now, on the subject of world building, you've actually done something revolutionary with Fuzzy Nation that I can't ever think of anyone doing, and this is where the Paul and Storm organization comes into the story. You have commissioned for Fuzzy Nation an end credits song.
Indeed.
A theme from Fuzzy Nation, if you will.
If you will, and not just any sort of song. We need to be clear about this, because if you are going to do an end credit song, it has to be a very specific sort of genre, which is, of course, the power ballad.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And when I was sitting there thinking, how can I, you know, make Fuzzy Nation stand apart from all the other books that are going to be coming out right around this time? Because, you know, there are other folks who are coming out with books. China Meville has a book coming out mm-hmm. next week. You know, so what can I do to bring attention? And I said, I know, power ballad. And who who among the people I know can do power ballad the way that I need it to be done? Because if you are going to do a power ballad, you have to hit that certain balance. I call it that the Diane Warren zone.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Of
so
pure power and yet complete vapidity.
Oh yes.
Right.
Yeah. So when Colton said no,
right.
what was your next? Sorry, that was a little inside thing, because Colton, we've made our bones sort of wandering on Colton's coattails, and no, that's I take no shame in saying that, because everybody's riding on somebody's coattails to some extent or another.
Absolutely, said the man riding on the coattails of Robert Heinlein.
Yeah, see, there you go.
Mr. Rogers didn't ride on anyone's coattails.
Oh, no, he rode on Mr. McFeely's coattails.
You know, this is going to places I don't want to actually have image in my brain. So, but no, actually, there was a time that I actually tried to commission some songs for.
Oh, that's right.
From Mr. Colton. This is back when Android's Dream was about to come out, and I thought, you know what? This seems like an up and coming, young, hungry, you know, musician who could possibly do with some money thrown his way for songs. And so I sent him the absolute wrong thing to do, which was like a multi-paragraph thing going, I'm a huge fan and I have this book that's coming out and you probably haven't heard of me, but I was thinking maybe you could do an entire song suite about it.
You could actually hear the lateral lisp in the email.
Yes, and it's just like, you know, and it was just completely like, ah! And he read it and he was like, I'm going to put this email away and I'm going to walk away from the computer. I'm going to go to my special safe place and shiver. So when time came to do a Fuzzy Nation, I didn't do that. I didn't contact Mr. Colton, because I knew, as much as I love his work, that he's already got his things that he was doing, and that also I thought that the certain specific sensibility that I was going for actually was more of a Pollen Storm sensibility, because Jonathan Colton's very much his own thing. You guys have a good history of being able to, we'll throw you into the fire and say, make a polka, or, you know, do something that's completely in the vein of a sea shanty or whatever. And you guys go, well, challenge accepted.
It's because we have the power. We can shit on anything.
Right. Exactly. And so I figured that you guys would, like I said, hit the balance between, you know, complete inspirational plus vapidity plus, and this is the thing that Paul and Storm bring to the party, a knowing love of the genre that you are simultaneously mocking. Yes. You know what I'm saying with that?
It's like, absolutely.
You cannot mock something unless you love it completely. It's sort of like people who try to make Star Wars jokes who aren't Star Wars fans. You know, they eventually just try to go Boba Fett. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it doesn't work.
It has to come from a place of a certain place of affection.
Right.
If not necessarily respect. you don't have to think a thing is great in order to enjoy it.
Right,
it's a common theme on the podcast.
Yeah.
Right. No, and that was exactly right. And I figured, you know, we are of a cohort age, even though I am a relatively ancient, about 360 days older than the two.
Oh my God, I can't even count that high.
You don't know what it was like back in 1969. That's all I'm trying to say.
Neither do you.
You don't know. Anyway. But that's the whole point is that we grew up in the place where, you know, they did have the power ballads. They did, you know, it is a particular thing that we are steeped on. And even if you're just like sitting there going, oh, God, Aerosmith, you used to do Walk This Way and now you're doing I Don't Want to Miss a Thing. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. At the same time, you're still sitting there going, where is my lighter? You know,
yep.
Lift it up. So, yeah, you guys were actually the perfect people for the assignment. I didn't go to anyone else. You were the A-list. You were the first choice.
Well, it's very flattering, and I really hope that this becomes the still alive for Fuzzy Nation.
The still alive for the literary world in general, I think.
Yes. I will tell you this. I just played it today for my mother-in-law. And that I thought was an acid test, because I was saying to her, I commissioned this song for my book. And she's like, you did what now? And I was like, no, it's awesome. You need to listen to this. And so I made my 63, 64 year old mother-in-law like listen to it. And she was like, you know, just basking in the, you know, all the parts of it, you know, the part where you guys start clapping and the journey, like, you know, melodies and the, you know, guitar solo and all that sort of stuff. And she was like, at the end of it, she's going, yeah, that works. I don't know what to say. It works. So if you've got, my mother-in-law is middle America, like, defined. Like, I will ask her, what do you think about such and such movie? And she's like, ooh, I want to see that. And I know immediately that's going to make $250,000 domestically, mm-hmm. right?
Uh-huh. Or,
you know, then I know it's going to flop horribly. She's just right that demographic. So, in fact, you've made something that speaks to middle America. Uh-huh. Well done, you.
Proud of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is very, maybe it's because it is so, the storytelling, it's that, okay, no fat in it, just get on with the great storytelling, that is very cinematic in
yeah.
that sense. And Paul and I have talked about how awesome it would be in an ironic way, of course,
right.
if, like Old Man's War, which is under development in the Hollywood right now.
Yes.
For it to actually end up as an end credit song. That would just be a cherry on top.
Well, like I said, I mean, it's sort of like the other thing about it is I think people will hear the song and they will get immediately what it's supposed to be doing, what it's supposed to be achieving, which, you know, is of course, the gold. You know, you sit yeah. there and go, what is this song about? It's celebrating the fuzzy man, you know, with his heart wings and everything.
Yep. And we discussed this, you know, over email with each other. And most people probably kind of get this, but part of the approach that we took was in sort of a meta way was to imagine that this song had already been written about something else, maybe a Native American or maybe just, yeah. you know, some war hero or something.
Or just some notes that they had laying
yeah,
around.
Just these, you know, random noble sentiments. And then Hollywood came knocking and said, we need an end credit song. And so they said, well, we'll just awkwardly shoehorn this song onto this content. We'll throw in a little reference here or there that doesn't really quite fit into the body of the song, but it's okay. It'll work great. My own personal inspiration, even though it's sort of not quite a direct thing, is Cyndi Lauper's Goonies Are Good Enough.
Yeah. Uh-huh. When you describe it that way, you know what the song I actually thought about was?
What was that?
The Jack Parr or John Parr song,
yes.
Saint Elmo's Fire.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that was specifically written about, you know, a man, you know, who is a paraplegic, you know,
yep.
doesn't, you know, is going to go on and achieve. And they were like, well, this is a great song. Can you put something about St. Elmo's Fire in it? It's like, done.
Yep. Yeah. To shout that a couple times.
Yes. St. Elmo's Fire. You love that. And
yep.
so, yeah, no, you're thinking about that. And you're like, and because you listen to it and you're like, this could be, you take out Fuzzy Man and you put in, you know, any sort of X, you know, variable there, man.
Or Spider-Man or
Spider-Man
Superman.
Absolutely works in every possible way. And I think you should probably let Zack Snyder know because, you know, that new Superman is coming up. They will certainly need end credits.
We could even do, you know, Avengers Man.
Right. The Pizza Man.
Sure. Plumber Man. Why not?
Pizza Man actually works out very good.
Yep.
You know that, and then you can get into like sort of the Domino's or Little Caesars sort
oh,
of.
Oh man, you're thinking even more commercially than we are. I like
yeah.
I like your moxie, kid.
Cheddar your jib.
Now we've got a product placement rep. This is fantastic.
All I'm saying is that, you know, like I said when I came to you, I said, you know, I have an idea you need to deliver. And once you've delivered on this idea, I want you to go. I want you to maximize every possible income stream you can. I'm all about that.
Oh,
I said, my room, you know, bathed in hammered gold leaf. I don't like to brag, but.
No. If you have gold leaf, you flaunt that. You flaunt
right,
that.
Exactly.
That's what that's my grandma always used to say. Have gold leaf, flaunt the gold leaf.
Kind of switch gears a little bit.
Yep.
You're probably an exceptional case as an author because you have your blog, whatever, that you've been mm-hmm. running since 1902 or so,
right.
That you get a lot of feedback for your writing.
Yeah.
But for us, like as musicians who tour, we go out on a stage, we perform, the feedback is very immediate. With
mm-hmm.
any type of written work, especially a novel where, sure, some people are going to chew through it, you know, as soon as they get their hands on it. But when do you really get a sense for how a launch is going, how something is being received?
There's a couple of ways. I mean, part of it is with books in particular, there is a little bit of run-up where you start getting the pre-release reviews. Mm-hmm. And you start seeing those in like Library Journal or in Publishers Weekly and stuff like that. And those are your first sort of early signals about where the book is going to go. Because if they're you know, excited, they're like, this is a great book and so on and so forth. And that's something that your publisher can build on and start using it to get other sort of publicity and excitement. And whereas, you know, alternately, if they are completely like, this book and its author should be set on fire, then, you know, that also tells you kind of where things are going to go from there. So there, that's part of that. If you, when the book comes out, the day that the book comes out is also the first day of my book tour. So that will be the second thing where, you know, you go out on the book tour and then you see how many people show up. And I'm sure you guys know. I mean, it's like, you remember when you were in high school and you had those dreams that you went to class a half hour late and you missed the final and all that sort of stuff, doomed to repeat. Yeah. Now there's that. I have those dreams where I go out on tour and nobody shows up for the book tour. Ugh. And so I'm basically there going, you know, performing in front of an empty room, you know, with the people at the bookstore sort of doing the Artie Fufkin thing of, this is my fault. I didn't tell people about
it. This ass for a man, I'm telling you.
Right, exactly. So, you know, that's part of it as well. But the other thing is that these days, especially, you know, you do, you know, I have a Google search matrix that's set up for basically anytime anybody even utters the word Scalzi anywhere on the internet, it just boing, comes up in my face. So I know pretty much exactly how people are who are choose to speak about it respond to it.
I'm so glad we're not the only people who are like that.
Oh no. I've been doing this for years. It terrifies people because, like, from time to time, you know, they'll say my name, you know, on their blog about something, and then I may pop in with a comment like 2 minutes after they posted this, and they're like, "Don't do that. That's just creepy." Right.
Asmodeus, yes.
Right. And the third thing that you do is also, frankly, you know, after the first week, you get the book scan reports and you know exactly how much you've sold that first week. And that's a whole another level of author anxiety. So all of that basically gives you a sense of where it's going. I've been fortunate with Fuzzy Nation so far. I mean, the reviews so far have been very good. Mm-hmm. We got a couple of starred reviews, which is a very positive thing. The early sales reports seem to be pretty positive. And, you know, I tell people I am going on tour, they're like, you know, and when I say these are the places I'm going, instead of saying, why would you come here? I get people going, why aren't you coming to X, Y, Z? And so it's nice to feel that sort of that people actually do want to show up. I'm still paranoid that next Tuesday I'll go to my first appearance and they'll be like, it'll be my mother-in-law and my wife and some guy who thought, you know, that it was the Pat Rothfuss you know, appearance. But we'll see how it goes.
Now, talking about that, how long of a tour will you be on for this book, and is it all one stretch or is it broken up at all?
This particular stretch is going to be a 3-week stretch, I think I'm going through like a dozen cities, and let me see if I can count them off my head. Dayton, Columbus, Cincinnati, Lexington, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Salt Lake City, Washington, D.C., where I will be for the Nebula Awards, but there will be a mass signing. I'll be doing a signing along with that. New York City, where I'm doing a New York City appearance with Lev Grossman and Catherine Valente and Scott Westerfeld and somebody else whose name I'm completely blanking on. And then Phoenix for a combination Comic-Con there, the Phoenix Comic-Con, and another bookstore appearance. So I'm basically out of the house from the 10th until the 30th, which I know you guys will be like, big deal, right?
Not so long trip for us.
yeah. But it'll be 3 weeks and it'll be very draining. I mean, you guys know this. It's like people don't believe this, but it's sort of like when you go out you know, you show up on these things, you really are, I really am performing from the moment that they, you know, say John Scalzi, and then I do my reading, then I do questions, interviews, you know, do the signing. And that's, you know, it's a 4-hour day, and it just completely sucks the life out of you.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
The first time I did a book tour, they said, you know, here's your itinerary, because that was also a 3-week schedule. They said, here's your itinerary, and here are your handlers for each place that you go. And I'm like, why do I need a handler? I'm not 12. And the answer was, by the second day of my tour, you know, by the time I was done, I was just completely wiped out. You know, I had these nice old, you know, older ladies who are like, okay, come on, we're going to go get you something to eat, and then we're going to put you to bed, and someone will come wake you up and get you off to the airport. I mean, I would have been completely nuts if I had to do what you guys do. Is like, you do your performance, you do all the signings and stuff afterwards, and then you pack everything up and go to the next place. I don't know how you guys do it. Yeah. I suspect amphetamines are involved.
Oh yeah, it's all about the drugs and the hookers. So
oh yeah,
that's what gets you through. So if you're listening, please do make sure you go and see John Scalzi when he comes to your town and contribute to the deadening of his soul.
And if he's not coming to your town, make sure that you let him know vociferously, both via email and on his discussion forums, complain why he is not coming to your particular town, because it's, of course, all up to him.
Yes, yes, exactly. I was the one. I am responsible for everything involved with the book tour. Yes, it's all me.
Now, do you... I mean, obviously, you know, having said what you just said, at best you have mixed feelings about it. But do you enjoy, when all is said and done, do you enjoy the book tour? Do you enjoy the reading? I mean, obviously, it's good to meet your fans, so I'm not going to ask some disingenuous questions like, do you enjoy meeting people who tell you you're awesome? But, you know, like, do you personally, you know, get a lot of satisfaction out of public appearances and readings and things like that? Or do you, or is that a little harder for you?
No, you know, actually, I do like it. I mean, it's sort of the thing of that, you know, I it's a high class problem to have. You know what I mean?
Yeah, where, yeah, we're all talking white wines here. Of course.
Right. Exactly. No, because, yeah, you know, I talk to other authors who don't, you know, do the tour, and I'm like, oh, God, I have a 3-week tour and it's going to be like this. And they'll be like, uh-huh. I'm stabbing you through the eyeball right now.
Yeah.
And so I totally get. But I actually, you know, it's a lot of work, but it's also really enjoyable because it is, I mean, it is fun to, you know, just the fact that, you know, you get to go, I'm going on a 3-week book tour that I have enough, you know, interest, yeah, that, you know, my publisher is like, yes, we will subsidize you for 3 weeks on the road. And you know, fortunately, you know, I don't have to do this, you know, all the time. This isn't how I make my money. But it is one of the, so, you know, it's not completely an egregious thing, but it is great to go out and it is great to meet people who are in fact excited to meet you and to, mm-hmm, be, for that small slice of time, you know, an actual sort of little celebrity, you know,
yeah,
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've often told people, you know, they say, you know, what kind of celebrity are you? Are you like a C-list, D-list? I'm like, well, I was a Q-list celebrity, but now that I've got the movie deal, I've rocketed up to like the, you know, N list,
right,
or something like that. But it is, it's sort of like you get this little slice of fame. It's sort of a single serving slice, and then you go home and nobody cares who you are anymore. And that's actually,
and you still have to clean up the dog poop.
And it's actually sort of really good because, you know, I know people who are actually genuinely famous,
yeah,
and they sort of have to live in a little enclave between like Wilshire and Malibu.
Mm-hmm.
And in that area, in that little like 10-by-10-mile area, they can go to Starbucks or go shopping and stuff like that. And they leave that area, you know, anytime they go into a grocery store, the people come up and go, oh, my God, do you know who you are?
Yeah.
And as much as that sounded sort of appealing when one was 21 or 25 or something like that, when one is coming up on 42, you know, it's sort of like, no, I think I'm okay not having that.
So you're not going to go Hollywood douchebag when Old Man's War becomes the shiz?
No, I'm going to stay the same old douchebag I ever was.
Excellent.
Now, John Scalzi, down home douchebag.
I think we have the title for this podcast.
Yeah, I think we do. I had another good question. Boy, wouldn't it be great if I could remember it right now?
Ask a bad question.
Okay, well, I know that, in fact, that was it. Okay, you're about to go out on a book tour for this book. What is the question you are going to get most sick of Maybe already are.
Aside from where do you get your ideas?
That's the topper. What can you do with that? I think the one that I'm going to get probably the most sick about, not because it's a bad question, but it's just the question I get asked over and over and over again, is what is the future of publishing? Because of the whole ebook thing, and you know, people self-publishing now, and you know, are publishers going to disappear, and so on and so forth. And it's sort of like, well, I could give you a glib answer, or I could give you an actual answer. The problem is the actual answer will take 40 minutes and will include graphs and charts and a PowerPoint presentation. So I will just end up being glib. Mm-hmm. And so that will be the one that I will get a lot. And the answer to that one is, you know, some things will change and some things will stay the same, just the way that they've changed before when there was a major change in distribution, and yet some other things also stayed the same. You know, the people have this myth of industry, whether it's publishing industry or the music industry, the movie industry or whatever, that they were completely static entities up until the last 2 years. Now everything is going crazy. In fact, you know, the publishing industry has gone through wrenching change every like 15 years or so, and it's mostly just completely oblivious. You know, most people are completely oblivious to it because they're not part of it.
Right.
And same with the music industry. You know, they had a wrenching change when they went from, you know, from 45s being the biggest thing to long playing albums being the biggest thing to the CDs and so on and so forth. And so just to let people have the context that, you know, the wrenching change we're going through now is status quo, in fact, for, you know, every industry. It's hard for people to wrap their brain about. And, you know, 10, 15 years from now, there'll be another completely, you know, huge wrenching change. And people will go, oh, my God, what's going to happen? Is everything going to collapse now?
Sure.
And you're just kind of like, you know, how to make people understand that? You can't, you know, they're focused on what's going on at the moment. So
at least until we all have brain pals.
Right, exactly. Soon you will be able to inject my stories straight into your brain, no optic nerve, you know, required, or braille if you play that way. And you know, it will be interesting. The way that I sort of describe it is, you know, for writers, although I think this is true with every creative endeavor, there are three types of creative people, which is, there are the dinosaurs, there are the mammals, and there are the cockroaches. Okay. Mm-hmm. The dinosaurs are the ones that when there is a wrenching publishing change or a wrenching change in the industry, they die out because their success was so tied into that particular business model that they can't cope and they go plunk.
Yeah.
Then you have the mammals, which are the people who are specifically designed to take advantage of whatever the new publishing model is or whatever the new creative model is. And they rise to success because this is their time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the cockroaches, who are, it doesn't matter what's going on, they keep selling, they keep having their career. And so if you're a creative person, you want to be a cockroach.
Yep.
Right? You just want to keep going and going, so at the end of time, it'll be cockroaches, you, and Cher.
Maybe that's the new title for this podcast.
It's certainly a bumper sticker.
Cockroaches Share and You, a Learner's Guide.
Now, I mean, I don't want to dwell on a whole separate subject too hard, because we've already been talking for about 45 minutes or so here. I'm just curious, because as musicians, we're sort of living in this strange time period where, you know, our MO generally for the past however many years, as Paul and Storm, certainly since the release of our third album, was we would write a song and then we were able to just put it right up on the internet right then and there, and not only give it to people but sell it to people and let people share it and put it out in this Creative Commons license, which is its own sort of not that we're revolutionaries, but this is certainly something undreamed of 10 years ago and not thought to be very likely even maybe 5 years ago.
Right.
we sort of stole Colton's business model with that. And I had not realized until I looked back on your Wikipedia page here that you did the same thing back in 99 with your second published novel. I guess you wrote it first, Agent to the Stars.
Yeah.
That you just put out online as a shareware novel, as they describe it, in 1999. How many people, I want to know, told you you were insane and high and an idiot?
I had a fair number. Before I go on to that, I just want to say that Colton's Coattails is my Pollen Storm cover band.
Hey, well played. Yeah. Well played, young Padawan.
I was waiting the entire podcast to be able to have something to do with that there. But to get back to it, you know, I wrote it, and when I wrote Agents of Stars, it was what I call my practice novel. It was the one that I wrote to see if I could actually write a novel.
Yeah.
And so when I was done with it, I really didn't want to have to deal with, you know, promoting it or trying to get it published or anything else like that. So I was like, screw it, I'll just put it up on my website. And I had people come to me and say, you're absolutely crazy. Why would you do this? You could probably sell this. And the answer was, I could, but, you know, this, why not do it this way? Just see what happens. You know, maybe something will happen with it here. Maybe it won't. If it doesn't, then that's fine. Because what I wanted to do with the novel, which was see what I, you know, see if I could do it, see where I needed to improve, see what things I already did well. I mean, it had already achieved its objectives when I typed the end. It didn't have, you know, any sort of afterlife intended. So the putting it up on the website was just an easy thing to do. And it was kind of interesting to see what would happen. Now, this was back in 1999 when I said to people, if you like it, send me a dollar, right? This was before PayPal and before anything else.
Yeah, and so, right.
So people had to actually physically mail me money. it's savage, right?
Yeah.
And yet in the space of primarily in the first couple of years, although it was still dribs and drabs up until I finally told people, you know, stop. I got sent like $4,000.
Wow.
And $4,000 at, you know, at the time is actually fairly close to what you make for, you know, your debut novel. The first, I mean, I sold Old Man's War. My advance for Old Man's War in 2003 when I sold it was $6,500. So it was in the ballpark of, you know, what I could have made selling it to an actual publisher. And then later on, it actually did get published. I got paid considerably more than $4,000 for it at that time. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a detriment. It was what it showed was a good story will have multiple lives. And so you can, for example, put something out for free or, you know, as a sample, and then people will go, hey, I like this. And then either pay you for your next thing or say, this is something that I would like to have on a permanent basis. So I'll do it in this way and give you money for it. And so it is kind of, you know, I see people today who are like, well, I'm going to put it out, self-publish, and they'll make money. And nobody's done this before, and it's a whole new paradigm. And I'm like, you know, 1999 calls. I'm waving to you from here. But, you know, the thing is that, you know, you can't be you don't want to be that guy that's sitting there going, what you did, I did a long time ago, and I need attention, pay attention to me. Because, among other things, you know, I'm doing okay now.
You found a lot of positive ways to get attention.
Right, exactly. I don't have to sit there shaking my cane. But it is one of those things where when people have found out that, yes, you can do stuff in a very indie sort of fashion and people respond to that, you know, I certainly wasn't surprised because that was part of my experience. I mean, given the choice between doing the publishing all myself and having someone else basically offload the work onto them, and all I have to do is focus on writing, I would rather focus on the writing because that's what I'm actually good at. Yeah. But certainly every once in a while I'll do something where I'll go, you know what, this is unclassifiable. There's probably nobody who would be interested in doing it the way that I would want it done. Therefore, the person who needs to get that done is me. And I still do that. I mean, to be quite blunt, the, you know, coming to you guys and saying, I want a hit single for my book. You know, it's not, you know, Tor, bless them, they've done great things in terms of promoting me and stuff like that. But that's not going to be something that's going to pop up in, you know, their marketing, you know, brainstorm sessions. This book needs a hit single. that's going to come from me. That's going to be something that I'm going to say, you know, I want this. And then we put it out there. And, you know, if it works, great. If it doesn't, then I still have this very cool song. You know, that's part of the whole deal. Some things you have to do yourself, whether you're doing it indie or whether you're working with a major publisher. Some things are, it's still your responsibility. Your career is still your responsibility, because if you don't take responsibility for it, who else will?
Yeah. It occurred to me too late. I mean, it was too late anyway, but it didn't occur to me until yesterday, actually, that if we'd been really smart, what we should have done was written the song, you commission the song and have it written much earlier, such that you could have gotten it into a little microchip so that when a person turns the last page at the end of the book, that song would start playing. I think there's a market for that. End credits.
I will tell you what, though. I mean, I'm your song. I think that I have plans for it beyond the initial release. I think that when the mass market paperback comes out in about a year, we'll definitely have to do remixes. We can do like video competitions and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
I'm personally waiting for, you know, the live version, because you guys are going to play it live, right?
Oh, naturally.
Oh, yeah. How can we not?
Right, exactly.
The problem is one of scale. It's probably going to cost us about $10,000 to hire the orchestra and the gospel choir.
All I want to know, will there be flash pots? Because if ever a song needed flash pots.
The question really is how many?
Yes. Right. They may be LED flash pots, but we'll make it happen.
How many too much flash pots?
You can never have too many flash pots.
We'll tell that to Great White, but too soon?
Do you know how many times I've pulled up on using Great White as a cover band joke?
Yeah, it's a tightrope.
It is. It really is. It really is. But yeah, no, I'm actually looking forward to this. So I think that there's a lot of potential for Fuzzy Man to have an afterlife that it just keeps going and going and going and will become, I believe, the Don't Stop Believin' of our time.
Hex yes. And we are certainly rooting for the best of launches for Fuzzy Nation, and not just because we have a tangential personal interest in it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure. Last question. Let me think of the most sort of bullshitty morning radio Today Show, AM Philadelphia kind of question. What is something that people don't generally – give us one fact people don't generally know about John Scalzi? You know, like you're an expert at making crepes or something.
Up until the age of 16, I had Fabio hair.
No shit.
Which we saw.
Did we see that? I have forgotten completely.
No. There's actually, if you go to, I have a Flickr set that's called Narcissism. I actually have a picture of me at age 17 where I have this feathered head of hair that just looks like I look very John Stamos-y, which for the 80s was very super hot.
Oh, sure.
Sure.
And you know, the problem is that, you know, the people look at the pictures that of me when I was younger and they go, wow, that's a kind of an interesting looking guy. Who is that? And I was like, that's me. Yeah. They're like, no, that can't possibly be you. That's too good looking. I don't know what to make of that. But it's that whole thing of, you know, there are some people that they look the same, whether they're age 15 or age 50.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm apparently not one of those people.
You're a metamorph.
Yeah.
I guess it is. And what I say to my wife, because I asked my wife, she said, I said, do I look the same as when you met me? And she's like, oh, honey, no. And I'm like, but you still like me, right? And she's like, well, no, you know, it's you have a good personality. Oh, if it's my wife saying that, I'm doomed.
That's cool. I got to admit, when I first heard of you, and I don't remember exactly the circumstances, but when I hadn't read any of your stuff and someone had mentioned your name and recommended you, and I looked at your, I went into a bookstore and pulled out, you know, probably Old Man's War, and looked at your jacket picture, which is the one that's also on, you know, it's you in the t-shirt in front of the trees. I guess it's sort of your standard your standard picture. And my first reaction is like, wow, that's one angry looking dude. I really don't know if I would find him pleasant.
The funny thing about that picture is that people who know me only from that picture assume I'm like 6'5" and some sort of ex-Marine.
Yes.
That, you know, and then I show up and I'm this goofy 5'7" and change dude. And so literally like the first several times where people are like, John Scalzi, and they look for me and they're literally looking for me above my head. They're looking up there and I'm like, no, I'm down here. And you can tell that they're sort of, oh,
they're looking for Master and they find Blaster.
Right, exactly. And it's sort of like embargo, embargo on. And so that's where it is actually useful that I do have, redeeming qualities besides being, you know, buff sort of, you know, bald dude. We leave that to China Meville to actually be the, you know, the buff, really good looking science fiction writer. The rest of us scrape by as we can.
I guess when you put war in the title of your book, they have to make the picture match.
Right. Well, the story behind that picture is actually this. My editor sending me an email going, we don't have a cover photo for you. We need it in 15 minutes. And literally me going out with a camera and doing the thing that you do where you hold it out at length and take the picture. And so that's why it looks like it does, because I'm like, fuck, I look horrible. Click. And then I sent it in. I didn't even see it really until, I mean, I looked at it, but then I just sent it in. And it wasn't until I actually started getting pictures in it, I'm like, that doesn't really look like me. But, you know, for this particular book, it could sell some books. So yeah. I think it did.
I think we've discovered a lot of meaning here tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we've broken new ground.
Yeah. Certainly broken a time barrier in a good way.
And we've gotten to know the real John Scalzi, I think, in a way that nobody else has ever.
The 5'7" nerdy guy as opposed to the 6'5" ex-Marine.
That's right.
Who is terrific at making crepes.
I really am. I don't like to toot my own horn there. But the next time you guys come to Ohio, I'm making breakfast.
Oh, yeah. We're booking flights tomorrow.
You guys have the good pigs and beef in Ohio, too, don't you?
Good beef, good pigs. You know, we got Amish butchers. Come on down.
Oh, yeah, we are there.
You're on. So the standard kind of sign-off-y thing, Fuzzy Nation is, by the time you hear this, in stores everywhere, online. You can drop by John's house. I'm sure he has multiple copies and loves people coming by.
Drop by your local bookstore. Pick it up there.
Absolutely. It's also available online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Powell's, IndieBound, and basically any place where they actually sell those things known as books.
Is there an audio version available or imminent?
Indeed, there is. Audible.com is doing Fuzzy Nation, narrated by our friend, our mutual friend, Will Wheaton. And let me just tell you, Will Wheaton does a fantastic job narrating this. And for various reasons, as you guys know, and of course, as people will find out as they read the book, of anybody who could possibly have read this book, having Will Wheaton read it is absolutely the sweetest thing ever.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. I have read it already, and now I am torqued to hear Will read it.
Yeah. So. Yes. And I'm going to go out and purchase a hard copy that I will hold in my hands while I listen to Will reading it. And while I look at your ex-Marine jacket photo.
Right. And drag your fingers across the Braille version.
I'm going to get every possible sensory input that I can get version of this song. Do you have a scent, like Fuzzy Man, the scent by Armani?
I hadn't really planned on it, but you know, once the hit single goes completely gaga, mm-hmm. I think that it's inevitable that the fragrance will be coming. I think it'll be earthy, sort of musky.
Yeah.
As well it should be.
Smell like a fuzzy man.
Oh,
perfect.
There's a, I'm not sure I need it. Thank you so much.
I think on that.
Yeah, on that note, I'm not going to go through the whole shows that are coming. You can go to paulandstorm.com to find where we're going to be, because we're going to be numerous places over the summer. You can also go to scalzi.whatever.com or whatever.scalzi.com?
Whatever.scalzi.com, or just type whatever into Google.
Yeah.
Are you really the first thing that comes up under
you
whatever?
Can, you can check it yourself, man.
Oh, that's...
Amazingly, you're one of the few people that if you type their names in, it's not the Wikipedia entry that comes up first, and that's right. Very impressive.
Yeah, no, I'm. That's one of the virtues of being on the internet basically forever.
Yeah,
yeah.
Also go to pollenstorm.com to find out how to join the Brigade of Minions. Current minion designation is the Cool Ever Dudes, which is a very honorable designation.
It is at that.
And unless we have other business...
I don't think so. I think we've done plenty tonight.
We've done enough damage here.
Yes.
I'm Storm.
And I'm Paul.
And we've been talking about some stuff for 5 to 10 minutes.
On average. Links are in the doobly-doo.
Go do things.
Sometimes all we need is just some time. But when fear and hope tear your heart apart and your strength is on the run, you can find it again on the wings of a friend as you're climbing up to the sun. Buzzing man, how do you do the things you do? The magic lives inside of you. Reaching out and shining through. And if I can, I will do everything I can. So won't you help me to understand and take my hand, Buzzing Man. And the fussing, no he doesn't, cause he wasn't in the master plan. So lend a hand, won't you help me take a stand for the planet of the Fuzzy Man. Buzzing with the love of the Fuzzy Man. Does he give a damn about the cussing and the fussing? No he doesn't, cause he wasn't in the master plan. So lend a hand, won't you help me take a stand for the planet of the Fuzzy Man.
Spread your wings and fly away. Cause you don't have wings.
Reaching out and shining through.
I'm talking about the wings of your heart, little Fuzzy Man. I'm talking about your heart wings.
If I can, I will do everything I can. So won't you help me to understand and take my hand, Fuzzy Man.
Fly
them wide,
fly away to the sky,
fly away
so high.